Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Gregory Melville and Susan Fox and Kathleen Bromage.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to the news. It's the end of the week. It's time to talk about culture. Actually, it's always time to talk about culture, but here at the end of the week, we do the news. Today on the news, Tanisha Dugan, artistic producer at TheaterWorks. She joins us via the miracle of Skype. Lucy Gelman is editor of the Arts Paper and host of WNHH Radio's Kitchen Sink. Later on the show, we are going to discuss a new release. It's available on the HBO Max platform. It is called Judas and the Black Messiah. It is the story of Black Panther activist Fred Hampton and his murder. But I think even more significantly, it is the story of the man who betrayed him. And these roles are played by two amazing actors, two of America's really best actors of the moment. So, but before we do that, anytime Marty Scorsese talks these days, or more specifically writes, he seems to create a good nose topic. You may remember towards the end of 2019, he basically said that Marvel franchises and DC franchises were the equivalent of theme parks and kind of sending cinema to hell in a handbasket. Well, he still sees cinema on the same theme park ride that goes to hell in a handbasket, but he's got other things to say about it now. This is all in the course, actually, of a loving tribute to Fellini, I think on the occasion of a Criterion boxed set of Fellini's work. In Harper's, writing a lengthy essay about Fellini, but weaving in and out of that essay, essentially the contention that there might not be any more Fellinis because the business isn't really capable of presenting them and making sure that people see their work. He says that the art of cinema is being, these are his words, systematically devalued, sidelined, demeaned, and reduced to its lowest common denominator, content. He comes back to that word again and again. Anybody who works in any of these businesses, including where I work right now, knows that we are now content. We work for content companies. He says it's been good for filmmakers, himself included. Quote, on the other hand, it has created a situation in which everything is presented to the viewer on a level playing field, which sounds democratic but isn't. If further viewing is suggested by algorithms based on what you've already seen, and the suggestions are based only on subject matter or genre, what does that do to the art of cinema? And he goes on. As usual, this has created something of a backlash and then a backlash to the backlash. So let's have our people jump in on that. Once again, it's Tanisha Dugan and Lucy Gelman. Tanisha, what did you extract from Marty Scorsese's latest essay?
You know, a lot of things. One, I think I'm totally with you on like the net. We're all content creators, which makes me just think that we're all TikTok superstars. But I think, you know, I'm conflicted with what Marty has to offer, which is I appreciate democratization of culture. But I think there is something about curation, and I think there is something about this world of cinema that, to me, the kind of cinema he's talking about kind of emerged from the stages that I actually am interested in repurposing and resharing at a time like this. So I think while ultimately, Marty and I think, sit on different ends of the spectrum as it relates to how people access the work that we do, I think offering quote-unquote high art or ways inside a visual storytelling that isn't easy to make with your iPhone or, you know, something you've got at home is worth exploring and supporting.
Yeah, and although I would maybe say that I don't think, I mean, obviously all this takes place in, once again, his loving tribute to Fellini and all the masterful stuff that Fellini did with the camera. But I don't think Marty is, I think Marty is worried about the really brilliant thing that's made with your iPhone. I think that's one of the things he thinks you're not going to see because of this whole curation question that you bring up. Lucy, how did this go for you?
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, I'm very much on the same page as Tanisha, but I also think that, so we all hate algorithms. I think that's like the secret, right? Like, Marty is not the only one who hates algorithms. We all dislike them. And people joke about the sort of the targeted ads or the targeted movies that come up for them on Netflix or on Hulu or on Facebook, you know, the great blue menace at this point. But I think complaining about the amount of content also removes agency from the view. Like, I trust viewers to make their decision. I also think that there is a lot of really exciting content that is accessible to people because of streaming platforms in a way that it would not be otherwise. Now, like, are streaming platforms a good thing? Is the corporate takeover of cinema a good thing? No, probably not, but neither is Amazon, and we can talk about that all day. So that's kind of where I am. And then I also think, like, there is a really exciting thing that is happening with the democratization of these platforms. I mean, like, yes, you have to slog through a lot of awful content if you go on a platform like TikTok. But TikTok also gave birth to a musical about Ratatouille, where all of a sudden you could see YSD grads for not $600, which is what you're going to pay if you're seeing a show on Broadway. Of course, Broadway's closed right now. But, you know, I think to say this is the death of cinema really takes away from some of the exciting possibilities of the moment that we're living in.
Yeah, and I'm not sure you're really saying this is the death of cinema. I would also question whether we all hate algorithms. I mean, maybe you hate algorithms, maybe I do. I think people use algorithms. I don't think they think, oh, I'm using an algorithm right now. But they like the fact that Netflix shows them stuff that they might like. They like the fact that Amazon does the same thing. They don't want to have to wade through a bunch of stuff they don't like. I mean, I think there's a lot of us who object to it and who do feel exactly, as Scorsese does, that we're being shown a whole bunch of stuff. And then, I mean, I'll just say that last night, I was tired, but I wanted to watch a little something. And so it turns out, and I was already on HBO Max because we're doing this movie. And so it turns out that HBO Max, the sort of so-called classic content that they have, is kind of on a separate hub, as they put it, that is curated by TCM. It's not TCM, but somebody from TCM curates it. So it actually... it has some really good movies there, although it's also the case that apparently, like, All the Right Moves with Tom Cruise is a classic movie. I don't quite understand how that would be, but or like The Electric Horseman, which is kind of an okay Robert Redford movie, but like a classic, like The Searchers or something. I don't think so. But anyway, you know, so I decided I would watch a little bit of A Hard Day's Night, which I haven't watched in a long time. And I was watching it, and I didn't want to watch the whole thing, but it made me think of how much I like Richard Lester's directing. And so I thought, well, I wonder who's got Richard Lester's Three Musketeers movies right now, the Oliver Reed, you know, Michael York ones that are so terrific, Charlton Heston and Faye Dunaway. So I type that into search, and it turns out Amazon has it. Amazon has it for free. So I watched, you know, I don't know, 45 minutes of that too. But I thought, none of this is going to be offered to me if I don't go looking for it. And those aren't even really great movies or anything. They're just kind of good movies. And I think that that really is important that, yes, Lucy, to your point, there are lots and lots of really terrific, independent, low-finance stuff that's crawling up onto these platforms. And for that matter, it's never been easier if you do Criterion or Canopy or one of these things to watch a Buñuel or for that matter, HBO Max, to watch a Buñuel movie or a Fellini movie or a Bergman movie. But it's also never been less likely because they're distracting you all the time with this other stuff.
See, I totally disagree with you, Colin. Okay. I think that argument really undersells and does not trust viewers. And so two things. If we're going to talk about low art, I think there's no problem with someone who needs an escape from the fact that we're going on 12 months of it's like the most horrible 12 months I can remember in a long time in my life, at least. And if they need an escape by watching a dumb show about people getting married on a desert island or something like that, right? There's nothing wrong with that. But I also think it completely does not trust people to go out and look for content. And I know that there are so many friends and colleagues that I have that I can think of who work in different fields who really do go out and they seek lists of small budget films, of these older films that are now on streaming platforms, of foreign language films that have received great acclaim, but maybe aren't so well known. And all of a sudden, those are accessible. So I suspect
you're talking about a very specific demographic, though. I think, you know, for me, while I think having the ability to find these things, I think there's something, and I think we talked about this, you know, when I was on the nose last, you know, one of the reasons why the endorsements are such a juicy part of the nose week to week is that people that you kind of trust or at least have known for some time are telling you, hey, check this thing out. And part of, you know, the uniqueness of the selections and the TCM, curation for this month, and your sort of curiosity, Colin, about like, well, why did this one end up in this mix, is because it's chosen by a person with a particular set of tastes. And I think that's really important. I think, yes, having the rabbit hole offering is great, but it's the same as like going to the library, right? There's a certain demographic of folks who go to the library, and I'm probably talking very old school, who would be like, yes, let me go down every aisle and pick what draws me, whether it's because of the cover or because of the author's name. But most people are like, hey, librarian, I want to learn about this, or I want to read about that. Tell me what book to pick up. And I think we're in this interesting space between have at it, folks, go to the library and pick up whatever you want, and a lack of librarians, to carry out the metaphor, that kind of can say to you, you just saw a Fellini movie, you just saw a Martin Scorsese movie, you might also like XYZ element of P, and you may never have thought of this thing, because I happen to be an expert on movies and have an understanding of where you might find something that would draw you that you may not know based on your own experience.
Yeah, I just, like, in the episode you're talking about that you were on recently, one of the points that I made is that, and Lucy, I'm going to argue that all of us are kind of in bubbles, you know, and you're in kind of a New Haven arts bubble, you know, which is a real bubbly, it's a pretty small and pretty selected bubble, you know. For example, when the Golden Globe nominations comes out, I think this might be part of what Tanisha's referring to, there was outrage that I May Destroy You had not gotten a lot of, you know, nominations. And so I looked it up on its air dates when it actually dropped on its cable platform, which is also HBO, I think. They had audiences of like 80,000 or 84,000 people watching this. I mean, that's a really, really tiny audience for the major release of something. And I think, you know, Lucy, I love that you credit, you know, consumers of art with the ability to self-curate. But I do think that that's a very, very small and selected group of people. I think more people are watching Tiger King than are watching 8 and a Half, not just because they need some relief, but because they couldn't be bothered to go find 8 and a Half or something else unless somebody gives them a reason to do it.
Or Bridgerton, right? Because the marketing heft behind a project like a Bridgerton will bring it to the masses in a way that the marketing, you know, heft behind I May Destroy You is not the case. And I suspect there's part of that Martin Scorsese is talking about, right? Like when he says cinema, it's also the infrastructure behind a movie that supports its release into the world, not simply the art of it, which I think he's also talking about. But if there's no one to say, hey, watch this thing, or there's no real marketing effort to get the word out about a project that he is making, I'm not sure Martin Scorsese stays relevant in a time like now, right? And I think there's a little bit of self-preservation in kind of what he's talking about too. Sorry, Lucy, I heard your voice.
No, you're fine. I always chuckle at thinking, oh, an older white man making an argument for self-preservation. I've never heard that before. I still would push back against the bubble, not because I don't like to think of myself in a bubble, but sure, maybe New Haven is like crunchier and artsier. But I think we are also at a point where we're desperate, or I should say I am at this point where because it's the winter, because folks can't see each other or be in each other's homes, I think there's a desperation for social interaction. And a lot, again, a lot of these suggestions are coming from not just like lists that film critics are putting out, but also movies that friends are watching, and not just friends in New Haven, friends around the country. So I don't know. I mean, I also think there's the question of like how much of this is just nostalgia for a time that is lurching forward that we can't do, like we can't do that much about the corporate takeover of any sector of America after a certain point. I mean, that's sad to think about, but I think like, you know, how much of this is just Scorsese feeling powerless in a certain moment as well?
I know I'm going to push back against that. And I'm really going to push back against the white guy self-preservation thing. And I'll give you an example. I'll give you an example. All right. So if you go on that HBO Max TCM curated classic hub there, one of the movies you can watch is called Black Girl. It's a movie by the Senegalese director Ormane Sembene from 1966. Now, the reason it's there, and probably the reason there's a usable print that they can that they can extract and do whatever they have to do to put it on a streaming platform, is probably Marty Scorsese. Marty Scorsese founded the World Cinema Project to preserve the work of lesser known foreign directors, specifically Sembene, the Senegalese director, is one where they've really made an effort to make sure his films don't get lost. But there's tons of more examples. This is a guy who, yes, he's made a lot of gangster movies, but he spent a lot of his career fostering the work, A, of directors of color, foreign directors, young directors, independent directors. You know, I don't think he has to preserve himself anymore. He's going to be fine. He's releasing Killers of the Flower Moon, on Apple Plus of all places, ironically, pretty soon, with DiCaprio and Jesse Plemons, who's in the movie. Marty Scorsese is going to be fine. He really is, I think, genuinely worried that people won't have the experience that he had as an asthmatic kid or whatever he was, and he couldn't go outside and he fell in love with movies and he could find all these incredible movies. He's worried people are not going to find Fellini. He's worried that people are not going to see this stuff that he loves so much. I think the days of Marty worrying about his self-preservation are kind of over at this point. He's 78 years old and he's a giant.
I feel like it's a both and, right? Which is that, yeah, I agree with you, Colin. There's no way that like film history does not include a chapter on Martin Scorsese. Absolutely not. But I do think between now and when he departs to another plane, we may not be so interested in the things that he's making. I also think you're absolutely right that this is an art question for him. This is a question about whether or not people will access these things. And I also think it's a question of whether or not people will continue to make these things in this way, right? I mean, yes, he loves Fellini. There are like years of interviews where he speaks so much about how much he loves Fellini. But what Fellini offers that isn't really happening in filmmaking right now is something that is visually arresting, that is making a case for some what we would call, you know, outside of realism, I would call theatrical. You know, this idea that we're putting on screen something that is exactly like life, I think needs to be challenged. And I think the films that he loves, the films that he's talking about, this particular filmmaker, Fellini, is a piece of the art form of filmmaking that I don't think is au courant, right? I don't think that's where the zeitgeist is right now. And I think he's making a case, not only that are people not watching it and not being led to find it and then go, ooh, I love this, I want more of this, but that, you know, whether it's reality television, which I think has a lot to do with what we're experiencing right now, or something else, the work that we're seeing is very much like, let me plop the viewer in the middle of life, any kind of life. And unless you're going to see a Marvel movie, or you're seeing something that is called fantasy, you're not getting a play on life. And I use that with all the puns. That kind of takes you outside of real life and allows you to begin to think critically or in a different way than how you understand the world you're looking at.
I'm hanging back here, although I want to say, Lucy, one thing I do really agree about is the importance of people, of community, which we don't have enough of right now because of the pandemic. And it is true. I mean, I'm older than you guys, so a lot of the Fellini watching that I did, although I'm actually going to watch 8 and a half maybe this weekend because they actually have it on HBO Max. But, you know, I mostly did it in college. And why did I do it in college? Because we were all going to the movies in college, you know, and somebody said, well, we got to go see Fellini. And like my friend Bill Curry is one of the people, I don't know if how recently he's done it, but for years he would drag people to Bergman movies, people who were not necessarily grateful at the end to have, you know, get three of his friends in the car to go see The Seventh Seal or something. People don't necessarily shake your hand and thank you at the end of that, but that's we do that for each other, and we do it more when we're younger. When you get older, I just don't think there's as much of, at least, that kind of thing. Maybe there's, hey, you should rent The Last Black Man in San Francisco. It's a really great movie. But I do agree that culture plays a role in all this, and we do it for each other. But I once again feel that there's a very self-selecting quality to that, too. I'm just not sure all over America how much of that's getting done.
Was that a question?
Yeah, or whether, I don't know whether you wanted to say more about that.
No, I mean, I think that's true. The flip side is that I miss, as I think many of us, if not all of us do, like I really miss movie theaters, right? And screening rooms and these places that are magical where you can see these things happen. And I think, Colin, you're absolutely right. There's nothing like walking into a small theater and seeing an old film that is preserved, presented in beautiful quality on a big screen, right? But I just still don't know if I buy his argument. I think there is still art happening that takes us to magical, experimental places. I understand the fear that like people won't find that because they're watching Bridgerton or because they're watching Tiger King. That's as far as I'm going to go.
Well, you know, I think curation can happen in other ways. And you know who I think is a terrific curator in the way that Scorsese hopes people will be is Obama. You know, I mean, we did Atlantics, another Senegalese movie, actually, Atlantics here on the nose, partly because Obama had on his list of really great movies from that year. You know, I think he's somebody who's really makes an effort when he puts out all these lists of, I read these books and I like these movies and I like these songs. You know, he's kind of doing a curation in a way that Scorsese talks about. I think what Scorsese thinks is you shouldn't need an unusually culture avid ex-president. There should be something that's more kind of endemic to the movie business that's doing that. Tanisha, you probably get the last word here.
Well, it sounds like if I take where you're leading us towards, Scorsese is suggesting that studios are better positioned for that. And I actually think, love him or hate him, the sort of human connection, you know, of an Obama or your friend or your favorite writer in whatever publication you love, or this guy on the radio you spend every day with, that matters. And in a time like now where community is hard to find, as you said, Lucy, it's hard to really dig into the folks that you care about. Having those sort of folks to tell you, hey, you know, I really love this thing, you should check it out. It means a lot. And I think it's going to mean a lot moving forward. I don't see us coming back to public spaces in the same way, unless they're people that we already know and that are part of whatever the pod looks like, you know, post-vaccine. But I think we're going to rely on trusted folks that aren't just already in our universes to sort of say, make sure you check out Soul.
Yeah. I think we're going to rent small multiplex theaters and go to them with our friends. And maybe we will, to Lucy, to your point, you know, we'll all say, oh, you know what? Let's rent a movie theater and make them show, you know, whatever. Make them show Atlantics or some really cool independent movie. And just us. And we'll sit wherever we want to sit. And nobody will sit too close to anybody they don't want to sit to. And, you know, if Gorman Bichard is there, no one will chew popcorn too loudly. Whatever. But you know, we may wind up doing that. We may wind up curating our audience, our fellow audience members, as well as what we watch. All right. I'm talking too much. Let's take a break. We're going to come back. We've got this very interesting movie to talk about.
What happened? Hey, Marty. Hey, Marty. Hey, Marty. What happened with you? Saturday we had a party.
A party.
Frankie and Lou, everybody but you. Where was you Thursday? Hey, Marty.
Hey, Marty.
Hey, Marty, for our bowling game. It seems like a year since we chucked them out the field. Hey, Marty, you must have a...
You can jail a revolutionary, but you can't jail a revolution.
That's actually a piece by Fred, by Curtis Noasad called Never Forget What They Did to Fred Hampton, which we played on the show in 2019, or probably in 2020 when it was released in 2019 in our Best Jazz of the Year show that came up. So Fred Hampton is also one of his many things, and that's his actual voice at the beginning of the show. In the movie Judas and the Black Messiah, when you hear his voice, you hear Daniel Kaluuya, the amazing, amazing actor who is paired up with Lakeith Stanfield, who's an even more amazing actor, in my opinion, who plays Bill O'Neill, the man who betrayed not only Fred Hampton, but many, many, many other black activists and the Black Panther Party in general. This is Shaka King's studio feature film directorial debut, with some producing help from Ryan Coogler, not insignificant, I think. And there's a lot to say about this real-life story from our not-that-distant past, and kind of part of a pattern right now, too. It's the trial of the Chicago 7, which showed us at least a little bit of Bobby Seale, and now we've got coming out all at the same time, pretty much, the United States versus Billie Holiday, which is the story of Billie Holiday's encounters with the Federal Bureau of Narcotics, and also Sam Pollard's a documentary about Martin Luther King and the FBI, MLK/FBI. So here at Black History Month, we're kind of exploring a kind of black history that doesn't always kind of make it onto the playing field. So I've talked too much again. So let's go to our panelists, Tanisha Dugan and Lucy Gelman. Lucy, why don't you get us started here? Let's talk a little bit about this movie, just in general. Give us your thumbnail.
Yeah, I really, really enjoyed the movie. I think it's the first time I've watched something for your show that I enjoyed, actually. So props there, Colin.
I said you and Carolyn Pink. Yeah, right. I love it.
That's right. There was a zombie movie that wasn't horrible, but I want to make sure that we make room for not only Daniel Kaluuya and Lakeith Stanfield, who are standouts in this movie, but also Dominique Fishback, who plays mm-hmm. Deborah Johnson. And I actually think she is the unspoken or perhaps spoken star of this movie. She really was for me. But I have been thinking a lot about how many moments were not taught in history and how there is something really exciting happening in cinema, or if you don't want to call it cinema, just film or movies right now, that is sort of revisiting that history. And it's revisiting that history through the eyes of Black filmmakers, some of whom have not been able to make their work or present their work to a large audience before. And I think that's really exciting. It also worked for me because I have just been thinking a lot more about the Panthers and the legacy of the Panthers in New Haven, which plays a very small but meaningful role in this movie. Last year, of course, was the 50th anniversary of the Panther trials, and there was a lot of art and culture around that in the city. And so that was very present for me while I was watching the film.
Yeah. Tanisha, yeah, I just want to hear kind of off the top of your head.
I've got I have a million things shooting out of my brain as it relates to this film. I will start with you played some music and the soundtrack for this project is amazing. I will piggyback or rocket launch off of what you're saying, Lucy. I think Dominique as Deborah Reynolds is amazing. That final scene could be played a million and one ways, and to see just sort of the resignment and strength as opposed to sort of this the choice of being in a puddle was just so essential to the way Black women move through this space. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, Nina Simone said it best, right? An artist's job is to reflect the time. And I think what the proliferation of all of these movies means to me is a reflection of our American history that is not written through the vision of white supremacy, right? That is not written through the intent to maintain the hierarchy as it currently stands, but to reintroduce in some cases, to remind to my boomers of whence they came and the story that they left behind. And I'm excited for the work that's coming out right now and the stories and the history and the culture shifting that I think we're attempting to do. We'll see what happens. You know, in some ways, I think of I May Destroy You, you know, Colin, and sort of like, how will this elevate so that folks are really paying attention? It seems like this project is going to get the Oscar buzz or awards buzz, I should say, as it deserves. And that will help in telling the story. But, you know, Fred Hampton is not our favorite Black hero, right? And watching Black men, Black people, make a choice over their own personal survival or the survival of the people is difficult to see. But it was incredible. It was a good moment for me in this.
Before we go further, I want to play a little bit from the film. And since we're talking about Dominique Fishback as Deborah Johnson, let's play a clip that has her in it. Here, Deborah and Fred Hampton are talking. She's just read him some poetry. She is pregnant with his child. Let's hear a little bit of that.
Hey, what are you doing?
It's private. It's private.
You think you're going to be a bad mother?
It was a question.
Why you got to ask yourself that?
I don't know. Maybe the fact that I'm bringing a child into a war zone. These aren't considerations you have to make. You get to go out there, talk about dying a revolutionary death and how your body belonged to the revolution because you don't have another person growing inside your body.
So you regret it?
What?
I have my baby.
You?
When I dedicated my life to the people, I dedicated my life. You did?
So I want to ask both of you about what I think is kind of an interesting choice in this movie. And that is, you know, it's called Judas and the Black Messiah. And I would argue that despite the incredible poignance of a scene like that one and many other scenes in which Fred Hampton's character is prominently featured, it's a little bit more the story of William O'Neill. I mean, I think we see him more. We see the story through him. We see him being turned by the FBI in the form of a corpulent agent played by Jesse Plemons, who is going to then have the lead in the new Scorsese movie, but as I think a good FBI agent in that one, he's a bad FBI agent in this, and that character eventually threatens him first with prison, and then once he's turned, once he's been useful, threatens to feed him to the Panthers. But we see a lot of the existential dilemma of this young man, William O'Neill, who's kind of blundered into this situation and made the choices that he has. So I feel like, you know, the narrative of the movie is a little bit more through his eyes than Hampton's or anybody else's. But go ahead and push back against that or agree with it. Lucy, why don't you start?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I will say, Colin, when you said that, my mind immediately went to one of the first, if not the first shot of the film, which is sort of aimed at Bill O'Neill's back. And it's a beautiful and kind of arresting shot. And I think it sets the viewer up for at least that as one possible interpretation of the movie, that this is, if not a story of Fred Hampton and Bill O'Neill, you know, very much a story of Bill O'Neill. I don't know if I felt like it. Yeah, I don't know if I would totally agree with that. Because I feel like Stanfield, while he is tremendous in this movie, actually does not, there were times when I wanted him to have a little bit more to work with. That said, he does the sort of the, as you said, existential dilemma, the paranoia of that moment so, so well. And he just, he really commits to the character. And I think it may have been in one of the articles we read for the show that he, playing this character, actually pushed him to see a therapist. And I, and you completely understand why watching the movie.
Yeah, I just would, I would just add, and I want to hear Tanisha on this, that really the first shot of the movie is the real Bill O'Neill being set up for an interview in a documentary. And then the last thing you see in the movie before a lot of CG comes on and tells you a lot of stuff that I, some of which I really feel should be in the movie somehow. But anyway, the last thing you see before that is the real Bill O'Neill once again answering some questions from that documentary film group, which one of the things that makes me think that O'Neill is the framing device, the framing character for the movie more than Hampton is. But Tanisha, what are your thoughts?
I think I'm actually pretty sure that O'Neill is the hero of the story. And actually, it was in notes that he received when he shared it with Ava DuVernay and another director whose name escapes me, that the note came back that perhaps there should be some more Fred Hampton. So I'm not surprised that your experience of it is like, this feels like Judas with a side of Black Messiah, because I think that's, that is absolutely the case. And I think, you know, left to his own devices, I think Shaka King may have made a movie only about O'Neill with Fred Hampton really being a supporting role. I think that the framing of that is intentional. And I wish, you know, I don't know how many people sort of know the story of O'Neill, but I do kind of wish there was an understanding that, like, you're going to go full circle in this journey, because that interview that you see is, and you know, is O'Neill's last moment in many ways, right? When that was aired, the day it was aired, he committed suicide. That's not a spoiler alert. That is like history. And I do think that there's something about understanding the fullness of the story that, for me, gave me more insight into to the choices Lakeith was making. Because I think in a vacuum, I may have thought to myself, oh, he's treating the night of Fred's death so delicately. And there's so much conflict and emotion within this man. I don't know if I buy it. But I think knowing, you know, the journey of O'Neill in real life, seeing that much conflict, I think, is much more rewarding than I think without not having that context.
I want to hear what Lucy has to say. Quickly, I will say, if I have a criticism of this movie, although I really do just worship these two actors, but Bill O'Neill was 17 years old when he was recruited by the FBI.
Yeah.
Lakeith Stanfield is 29, and he doesn't look any 17 years old. He looks like, to me, a young man, you know, who's about 29 years old. In fact, Lakeith Stanfield looks like he'll be a little bit older than 29 at times. But so, I mean,
when you look at O'Neill's interview, and he's supposed to be like 39, he actually looks very old. So you're also like, maybe this was just an old looking man. And also, like, that's what America does to Black people. We tend to be like evergreen until we start looking weathered.
But I do think that, because that really isn't, I mean, there is a moment at the beginning where O'Neill's trying to pull off a heist in a bar, and at some points the people in the bar go, wait a minute, he's just a kid, because he's pretending to be something else. But I don't think that point is driven home, that this is, you know, he makes all kinds of choices for which he is, you know, historically been kind of vilified. But he's 17 years old, you know, and he's trying to navigate this incredibly complex chain of coercion that goes right to the top with J. Edgar Hoover, played by Martin Sheen, which is a very weird choice. And I just sort of think, you know, and for that matter, Fred Hampton was, I think, 22 when he died. Kaluuya is in his early 30s. He doesn't really seem like, I mean, these are young guys.
Lucy, I want you to hop in, but I think, Colin, you make such an important point, especially as this project relates to shifting culture. And I think there's a conversation happening right now about Black children being treated as adults. And I do believe 100% that had the casting been more in line with the real ages of these people, that elevation of this conversation we're having amongst ourselves about treating Black children as if they're grown people could have hit so much harder. And while I agree, I love Lakeith, I love Daniel, I wish the casting had really forced us to reckon with what's happening right now, because it was easy for me to make the Breonna Taylor connection at the end of the movie. I think it's really hard to make the Trayvon Martin argument when you're looking at 30-year-old men. Yeah. Sorry, Lucy.
No, don't, please don't apologize. I agree with that 100%. I don't know how much more I have to say, although, Tanisha, I do want to just agree with you that the soundtrack is totally, it's, I was just geeking out the whole time. Mm-hmm. It did it for me. So many things about this movie did it for me too. But yes.
Well, the thing that punctuates so much of the movie is this kind of blaring, blatting horn chord, this kind of discordant, aharmonic horn chord that they keep hitting you with. And it, after a while, it really starts to rattle your nerves, I think, in a way that's it's very much intended to do. I do want to say, and then we'll have to probably take a break, but I'd love to get your reactions to this. There was a scene that intrigued me. Okay, so Jesse Plemons plays this kind of horrible guy who's just doing horrible things to Bill O'Neill so that he can do even more horrible things to Fred Hampton and other Black Panthers. But there's a scene where he meets with J. Edgar Hoover and another FBI agent, and Martin Sheen, who I adore, but I don't think he should have played J. Edgar Hoover, but he at one point turns to this fairly young FBI agent, played by Jesse Plemons, and starts saying, "How are your kids?" And he knows their names and ages. And I don't think that's to show what a pleasant guy Hoover is. I think that's Hoover saying at that point to this agent, if you think I don't have a dossier on you, if you think that you are operating at a level kind of above the muck pool that I've, you know, made you create there in Chicago, you are absolutely wrong. I've got you too. And I thought that was sort of an interesting touch. They don't really do very much with it, but I took that anyway as, you know, as a way of sort of saying, well, there are bigger powers than this cigar smoking, posh restaurant frequenting agent. I don't know. Anybody want to react to that?
I only want to react to Martin Sheen as cast as J. Edgar Hoover and say, I absolutely agree with you. But I also think that making Black filmmakers making movies is really hard. And so in some ways it's a reconnect to like, why did they cast these wonderful actors in these roles that really are meant for 17 and 21-year-olds. And I think it's about a kind of star power that helps to push this movie into green light territory, even though there's a lot of prosthetics that's happening with Mr. Sheen. Yes.
Lucy, you get the last word on this movie.
No, I think what does work about that scene, which is so much of what does work about this film, is that it makes a viewer, or at least it made me think about how much of this is still so very current today and how little the historical needle has moved in the intervening years. And so I think what does work about that is immediately my mind went to how much the surveillance state is still, I mean, that's still a mechanism of the times we live in today. And so, yeah, I was thinking about that. Although I agree on the prosthetics front, Tanisha.
All right, so it's Judas and the Black Messiah. I think this one, Marty would be happy because, I mean, I think HBO Max is really making also an effort to curate and showcase this and make sure it's there on your homepage when you jump on their platform. So we all recommend it, and we're going to take a break, and we'll come back. All right, we're back with The Nose. Got to say thanks to Kat Pastor. She's the technical producer there in the studio, making it possible for the rest of us to work remotely and making it possible for the show to sound good. Special thanks to Jonathan McPants, who's the producer of this and most other Nose episodes. At the same time he's doing this, he's putting the final touches on our final episode of Pardon Me, Another Damn Impeachment Show, which for its second season. And that's going to go up. It'll be available on the air tomorrow at noon. It'll go up as a podcast whenever Jonathan gets it done, but it's hard to do these two things at once. This particular episode, which I didn't want to do and fought against doing, is possibly for that reason one of the best we've ever done. I think this is just going to be a terrific episode. I really encourage people to listen to it. We've got great guests and commentary, and we got Wilfie doing factoids and all kinds of stuff like that. So a very unusual type of factoid. So maybe we should like hate the idea of what we're doing more often, because it certainly resulted in something really good. So please find some way to listen to Pardon Me when we get it ready for you. All right. Our wonderful panel today is Lucy Gelman and Tanisha Dugan. Tanisha, why don't you get us going with some recommendations?
I have one today, and it's the city of Baltimore and their Arts and Culture Transition Committee, as it was leaded by my dear friend Jessica Solomon. I encourage folks to read their transition report. The city of Baltimore is really envisioning a city in which arts and culture are deeply embedded in public life. And I think we all could learn a thing or two about including creatives in our process as we're building policy and the new vision for the world we want to live in. So shout out to Mayor Brandon Scott and the city of Baltimore and their Arts and Culture Transition Committee. Kudos, guys.
Wow, that's a really interesting one. I know nothing about this. I am going to track it down. Lucy Gelman, how about you?
Yeah, I have two really quick ones. I also love the city of Baltimore, so thank you, Tanisha. So the first is Steve McQueen's Small Acts series or film. It depends how you're thinking about it. When you are slogging through all of that content and going through the algorithms and you can't find what you want to watch, I recommend watching this series. It is really, really good and very powerful. And then the second is a conversation that the New Haven Free Public Library held earlier this week, but it's on YouTube if you just look for the public library, between the poet Reginald Dwayne Betts and Kaveh Khanum co-founders Toy Derricott and Cornelius Eady. So it's a conversation about poetry. It's also a conversation about how much they love libraries. And it reminded me in this period that I think every single person has at least one library story that is really close to their heart. And I sort of geeked out about the conversation. So again, if you check out just the New Haven Free Public Library on Facebook or on YouTube, you can find that conversation. And while you're there on the internet, I also just recommend like every single alumnus who has come out of Kaveh Khanum, treat yourself to some wonderful poetry this weekend.
All right. Yeah, people should be reading poetry all the time anyway. So I will recommend two things that are sort of, I don't know, these are the kinds of curation that Marty probably wants us to do, but sort of a guilty pleasure with maybe some substance to it is Sofia Coppola's new movie On the Rocks, with just a tremendous performance by Rashida Jones like crazy performance by Bill Murray. And I may not be a reliable witness on this movie because Bill Murray plays a version of a friend of mine who is very dear to me and is impossible and delightful in all of the ways that Bill Murray is as he portrays Rashida Jones's father in this situation. So, but the movie's I think it's a lot of fun. I don't know, maybe it's not as much fun as I think it is. And then The Sound of Metal, Riz Ahmed is another one of these just terrific young actors that we are lucky to have around ever since The Night Of. I have been following this guy. I think he's tremendous. He plays a metal drummer, also a recovering heroin addict, a recovering everything addict, I think he kind of says at one point, who loses his hearing. And, you know, that could be one of these kinds of overcoming hardship, overcoming disease stories, and, you know, that sometimes can be a little bit more of a cliche. I don't think it is this time. I think they do a lot with it. They do also, and as some of you know, our show has been very involved at times with the deaf community. They do a lot on the culture and politics of deafness in a way that you might not see in the typical kind of overcoming disease and hardship movie. So The Sound of Metal, really recommend that one. You might have to look a little bit for that one. All right. So we were lucky to have two terrific panelists today. Tanisha Dugan, artistic producer at TheaterWorks. Lucy Gelman is editor of the arts paper and host of WNHH Radio's Kitchen Sink. Listen to Pardon Me. It's season 2, episode 4. I don't know. I'm not sure. Is that right? Anyway, yes. Season 2, episode 4. We'll have it up for you on the podcast platforms very soon. I say we. Pants has to do all the work.
Danbury, Waterbury, Oliveberry, Woodbury, hitting on New Britain. Vernon, I already said that one. Avon, Farmington.
yeah, 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 yeah.